tubular protein chains that serve as girders and highways inside the cytoplasm of all cells, not just neurons. At Tucson 2, the second international conference on the science of consciousness, after Hameroff's exposition of this view, I asked from the audience, "Stuart, you're an anesthesiologist. Have you ever assisted in one of those dramatic surgeries that replaced a severed hand or arm?" No, he had not, but he knew about them. "Tell me if I'm missing something, Stuart, but given your theory, if you were the anesthesiologist in such an operation, you would feel morally obliged to anesthetize the severed hand as it lay on its bed of ice, right? After all, the microtubules in the nerves of the hand would be doing their thing, just like the microtubules in the rest of the nervous system. And that hand would be in great pain, would it not?" The look on Stuart's face suggested that this had never occurred to him. The idea that consciousness, of red, of pain, of anything, is some sort of network property, something that involves coordinated activities in myriads of neurons, initially may not be very attractive. But these attempts at reductios may help people see why it should be taken seriously. 3. Rappaport's rules. Just how charitable are you supposed to be when criticizing the views of an opponent? If there are obvious contradictions in the opponent's case, then of course you should point them out forcefully. If there are somewhat hidden contradictions, you should carefully expose them to view, and then dump on them. But the search for hidden contradictions often crosses the line into nitpicking, sea-lawyering, and, as we have seen, outright parody. The thrill of the chase and the conviction that your opponent has to be harboring a confusion somewhere encourages uncharitable interpretation, which gives you an easy target to attack. But such targets are typically irrelevant to the real issues at stake and simply waste everybody's time and patience, even if they give amusement to your supporters. The best antidote I know for this tendency to caricature one's opponent is a list of rules promulgated many years ago by the social psychologist and game theorist Anatole Rappaport, creator of the winning tit-for-tat strategy in Robert Axelrod's legendary Prisoner's Dilemma tournament. How to compose a successful critical commentary. 1. You should attempt to re-express your target's position so clearly, vividly, and fairly that your target says, "Thanks, I wish I'd thought of putting it that way." 2. You should list any points of agreement, especially if they are not matters of general or widespread agreement. 3. You should mention anything you have learned from your target. 4. Only then are you permitted to say so much as a word of rebuttal or criticism. One immediate effect of following these rules is that your targets will be a receptive audience for your criticism. You have already shown that you understand their positions as well as they do and have demonstrated good judgment. You agree with them on some important matters and have even been persuaded by something they said. Following Rappaport's rules is always, for me at least, something of a struggle. Some targets, quite frankly, don't deserve such respectful attention and, I admit, it can be sheer joy to skewer and roast them. But when it is called for, and it works, the results are gratifying. I was particularly diligent in my attempt to do justice to Robert Caine's 1996 brand of incompatibilism, a view about free will with which I profoundly disagree, in my book Freedom Evolves, 2003, and I treasure the response he wrote to me after I had sent him the draft chapter. "In fact, I like it a lot, our differences notwithstanding. The treatment of my view is extensive and generally fair. Far more so than one usually gets from critics. You convey the complexity of my view and the seriousness of my efforts to address difficult questions rather than merely sweeping them under the rug. And for this, as well as the extended treatment, I am grateful." Other recipients of my Rappaport-driven attention have been less cordial. The fairer the criticism seems, the harder to bear in some cases. It is worth reminding yourself that a heroic attempt to find a defensible interpretation of an author, if it comes up empty, can be even more devastating than an angry hatchet job. I recommend it. 4. Sturgeon's Law. The science fiction author Ted Sturgeon, speaking at the World Science Fiction Convention in Philadelphia in September 1953, said, "When people talk about the mystery novel, they mention The Maltese Falcon and The Big Sleep. When they talk about the Western, they say there's The Way West and Shane. But when they talk about science fiction, they call it that Buck Rogers stuff. And they say, 90% of science fiction is crud. Well, they're right. 90% of science fiction is crud. But then 90% of everything is crud. And it's the 10% that isn't crud that is important. And the 10% of science fiction that isn't crud is as good as or better than anything being written anywhere. Sturgeon's Law is usually put a little less decorously. 90% of everything is crap. 90% of experiments in molecular biology. 90% of poetry. 90% of philosophy books. 90% of peer-reviewed articles in mathematics, and so forth, is crap. Is that true? Well, maybe it's an exaggeration. But let's agree that there is a lot of mediocre work done in every field. Some curmudgeons say it's more like 99%, but let's not get into that game. A good moral to draw from this observation is that when you want to criticize a field, a genre, a discipline, an art form, don't waste your time and ours hooting at the crap. Go after the good stuff or leave it alone. This advice is often ignored by ideologues intent on destroying the reputation of analytic philosophy, evolutionary psychology, sociology, cultural anthropology, macroeconomics, plastic surgery, improvisational theater, television sitcoms, philosophical theology, massage therapy, you name it. Let's stipulate at the outset that there is a great deal of deplorable, stupid, second-rate stuff out there of all sorts. Now, in order not to waste your time and try our patience, make sure you concentrate on the best stuff you can find, the flagship examples extolled by the leaders of the field, the prize-winning entries, not the dregs. Notice that this is closely related to Rappaport's rules. Unless you are a comedian whose main purpose is to make people laugh at ludicrous buffoonery, spare us the caricature. This is particularly true, I find, when the target is philosophers. The very best theories and analyses of any philosopher, from the greatest, most perceptive sages of ancient Greece to the intellectual heroes of the recent past, Bertrand Russell, Ludwig Wittgenstein, John Dewey, Jean-Paul Sartre, to name four very different thinkers, can be made to look like utter idiocy or tedious nitpicking with a few deft tweaks. Yuck, yuck, don't do it. The only one you'll discredit is yourself. 5. Occam's Razor. Attributed to William of Ockham, or Ockham, the 14th century logician and philosopher, this thinking tool is actually a much older rule of thumb. A Latin name for it is Lex Parsimoniae, the law of parsimony. It is usually put into English as the maxim, do not multiply entities beyond necessity. The idea is straightforward. Don't concoct a complicated, extravagant theory if you've got a simpler one, containing fewer ingredients, fewer entities, that handles the phenomenon just as well. If exposure to extremely cold air can account for all the symptoms of frostbite, don't postulate unobserved snow germs or Arctic microbes. Kepler's laws explain the orbits of the planets. We have no need to hypothesize pilots guiding the planets from control panels hidden under the surface. This much is uncontroversial, but extensions of the principle have not always met with agreement. Conway Lloyd Morgan, a 19th century British psychologist, extended the idea to cover attributions of mentality to animals. Lloyd Morgan's canon of parsimony advises us not to attribute fancy minds to insects, fish, and even dolphins, dogs, and cats if their behavior can be explained in simpler terms. In no case is an animal activity to be interpreted in terms of higher psychological processes if it can be fairly interpreted in terms of processes which stand lower in the scale of psychological evolution and development. 1894, page 128. Overused, this can be seen as enjoining us to treat all animals and even human beings as having brains but no minds. As we shall see, the tensions that arise when minds are the topic are not well settled by absolute prohibitions. One of the least impressive attempts to apply Occam's razor to a gnarly problem is the claim, and provoked counterclaims, that postulating a god as creator of the universe is simpler, more parsimonious than the alternatives. How could postulating something supernatural and incomprehensible be parsimonious? It strikes me as the height of extravagance, but perhaps there are clever ways of rebutting that suggestion. I don't want to argue about it. Occam's razor is, after all, just a rule of thumb, a frequently useful suggestion. The prospect of turning it into a metaphysical principle or fundamental requirement of rationality that could bear the weight of proving or disproving the existence of God in one fell swoop is simply ludicrous. It would be like trying to disprove a theorem of quantum mechanics by showing that it contradicted the axiom, "Don't put all your eggs in one basket." Some thinkers have carried Occam's razor to drastic extremes, using it to deny the existence of time, matter, numbers, holes, dollars, software, and so on. One of the earliest ultra-stingy thinkers was the ancient Greek philosopher Parmenides, whose catalog of existing things was minimal indeed. As a student of mine memorably wrote on an exam, Parmenides is the one who said, "There's just one thing, and I'm not it." I hate to say it, but that does seem to be what Parmenides was trying to tell us. No doubt it loses something in translation. We philosophers get used to taking such ideas seriously, if only because we never can tell when a crazy idea is going to turn out to be unfairly and unwisely judged, a victim of failure of imagination. 6. Occam's broom. The molecular biologist Sidney Brenner recently invented a delicious play on Occam's razor, introducing the new term Occam's broom to describe the process in which inconvenient facts are whisked under the rug by intellectually dishonest champions of one theory or another. This is our first boom crutch, an anti-thinking tool, and you should keep your eyes peeled for it. The practice is particularly insidious when used by propagandists who direct their efforts at the lay public because, like Sherlock Holmes's famous clue about the dog that didn't bark in the night, the absence of a fact that has been swept off the scene by Occam's broom is unnoticeable except by experts. For instance, creationists invariably leave out the wealth of embarrassing evidence that their theories can't handle, and to a non-biologist, their carefully crafted accounts can be quite convincing simply because the lay reader can't see what isn't there. How on earth can you keep on the lookout for something invisible? Get some help from the experts. Stephen C. Myers, Signature in the Cell, 2009, purports to expose the systematic impossibility of life having a natural, non-supernatural origin, and gives what seems, even to a relatively well-informed reader, to be a fair and exhaustive survey of the theories and models being worked on around the world, showing how irredeemably hopeless they all are. So persuasive is Myers' case that in November 2009, the eminent philosopher Thomas Nagel declared it his best book of the year in London's Times Literary Supplement, one of the world's most influential publications of book reviews. In a spirited correspondence I had with him after his rave appeared, he demonstrated that he knew quite a lot about the history of work on the origin of life, enough to think he could trust his own judgment. And as he noted in a letter to the Times Literary Supplement, January 1, 2010, Myers' book seems to me to be written in good faith. Had Nagel consulted with scientists working in the field, he would have been able to see Myers' exploitation of Occam's broom, whisking inconvenient facts out of view, and he might also have been dismayed to learn that the experts hadn't been sent an early copy of Myers' book, as he had, or been asked to referee it before publication. Learning that the book he admired was a stealth operation might have shaken his confidence in his judgment, or it might not have. The scientific establishment has been known to squelch renegade critics unjustly on occasion, and perhaps, Meyer had no choice but to launch a sneak attack. But Nagel would have been wise to explore this prospect warily before committing himself. It is fair to say that the scientists working on the origin of life do not yet have a secure and agreed-upon theory, but there is no dearth of candidates, an embarrassment of riches rather than an almost empty arena. Conspiracy theorists are masters of Occam's broom, and an instructive exercise on the internet is to look up a new conspiracy theory to see if you, a non-expert on the topic, can find the flaws before looking elsewhere on the web for expert rebuttals. When Brenner coined the term, he wasn't talking about creationism and conspiracy theories. He was pointing out that in the heat of battle, even serious scientists sometimes cannot resist overlooking some data that seriously undermine their pet theory. It's a temptation to be resisted no matter what. 7. Using lay audiences as decoys. One good way of preventing people from inadvertently wielding Occam's broom is a technique that I have been recommending for years and have several times put to the test, but never as ambitiously as I would like to do. Unlike the other practices I have been describing, this one takes time and money to do properly. I hope others will pursue this technique vigorously and report the results. I have decided to put it here because it addresses some of the same problems of communication that the other general tools confront. In many fields, not just philosophy, there are controversies that seem never-ending and partly artifactual. People are talking past one another and not making the necessary effort to communicate effectively. Tempers flare, and disrespect and derision start creeping in. People on the sidelines take sides even when they don't fully understand the issues. It can get ugly, and it can have a very straightforward cause. When experts talk to experts, whether they are in the same discipline or not, they always err on the side of under-explaining. The reason is not far to seek. To over-explain something to a fellow expert is a very serious insult. Do I have to spell it out for you? And nobody wants to insult a fellow expert. So, just to be safe, people err on the side of under-explaining. It is not done deliberately, for the most part, and it is almost impossible to keep from doing, which is actually a good thing, since being polite in an unstudied way is a nice character trait in anyone. But this gracious disposition to assume more understanding than is apt to be present in one's distinguished audience has an unfortunate byproduct. Experts often talk past each other. There is no direct cure. And treating all the experts present at a workshop or conference not to under-explain their positions may be met by earnest promises, but it won't work. If anything, it will make matters worse, since now people will be particularly sensitive to the issue of inadvertently insulting somebody. But there is an indirect and quite effective cure. Have all experts present their views to a small audience of curious non-experts. Here at Tufts, I have the advantage of bright undergraduates. While the other experts listen in from the sidelines, they don't have to eavesdrop. This isn't a devious suggestion. On the contrary, everybody can and should be fully informed that the point of the exercise is to make it comfortable for participants to speak in terms that everybody will understand. By addressing their remarks to the undergraduates, the decoy audience, speakers need not worry at all about insulting the experts because they are not addressing the experts. I suppose they might worry about insulting the undergraduates, but that's another matter. When all goes well, Expert A explains the issue of the controversy to the undergraduates while Expert B listens. At some point, B's face may light up. So that's what you've been trying to say. Now I get it. Or maybe the good effects will have to wait until it is B's turn to explain to the same undergraduates what the issues are, and provoking just such a welcome reaction in A. It may not go perfectly, but it usually goes well and everybody benefits. The experts dissolve some of the artifactual misunderstanding between their positions, and the undergraduates get a first-rate educational experience. Several times I have set up such exercises at Tufts, thanks to generous support from the administration. I handpick a small group of undergraduates, less than a dozen, and brief them on their role. They are not to accept anything they don't understand. They will be expected to raise their hands, to interrupt, to alert the experts to anything they find confusing or vague. They do get required reading to pore over beforehand so that they are not utter novices on the topic. They are interested amateurs. They love the role, and so they should. They are being given made-to-order tutorials from some big guns. The experts, meanwhile, often find that being set the task, well in advance, to explain their position under these conditions helps them find better ways of making their points than they had ever found before. Sometimes these experts have been protected for years by layers of fellow experts, postdocs, and advanced graduate students, and they really need the challenge. 8. Jutsing. It is hard to find an application of Occam's broom, since it operates by whisking inconvenient facts out of sight. And it is even harder to achieve what Doug Hofstadter, 1979-1985, calls jutsing, which stands for jumping out of the system. This is an important tactic, not just in science and philosophy, but also in the arts. Creativity, that ardently sought but only rarely found virtue, often is a heretofore unimagined violation of the rules of the system from which it springs. It might be the system of classical harmony in music, the rules for meter and rhyme in sonnets, or limericks even, or the canons of taste or good form in some genre of art. Or it might be the assumptions and principles of some theory or research program. Being creative is not just a matter of casting about for something novel. Anybody can do that, since novelty can be found in any random juxtaposition of stuff. But of making the novelty jump out of some system, a system that has become somewhat established for good reasons. When an artistic tradition reaches the point where literally anything goes, those who want to be creative have a problem. There are no fixed rules to rebel against, no complacent expectations to shatter, nothing to subvert, no background against which to create something that is both surprising and yet meaningful. It helps to know the tradition if you want to subvert it. That's why so few dabblers or novices succeed in coming up with anything truly creative. Sit down at a piano and try to come up with a good new melody, and you soon discover how hard it is. All the keys are available in any combination you choose, but until you can find something to lean on, some style or genre or pattern to lay down and exploit a bit or allude to before you twist it, you will come up with nothing but noise. And not just any violation of the rules will do the trick. I know there are at least two flourishing, well, surviving, jazz harpists, but setting out to make your name playing Beethoven on tuned bongo drums is probably not a good plan. Here is where art shares a feature with science. There are always scads of unexamined presuppositions of any theoretical set to, but trying to negate them one at a time until you find a vulnerable one is not a good recipe for success in science or philosophy. It would be like taking a Gershwin melody and altering it one note at a time, looking for a worthy descendant. Good luck. Almost always, mutations are deleterious. It's harder than that, but sometimes you get lucky. Advising somebody to make progress by jutsing is rather like advising an investor to buy low and sell high. Yes, of course, that's the idea, but how do you manage to do it? Notice that the investment advice is not entirely vacuous or unusable, and the call for jutsing is even more helpful because it clarifies what your target looks like if you ever catch a glimpse of it. Everybody knows what more money looks like. When you are confronting a scientific or philosophical problem, the system you need to jump out of is typically so entrenched that it is as invisible as the air you breathe. As a general rule, when a long-standing controversy seems to be getting nowhere, with both sides stubbornly insisting they are right, as often as not, the trouble is that there is something they both agree on that is just not so. Both sides consider it so obvious, in fact, that it goes without saying. Finding these invisible problem poisoners is not an easy task, because whatever seems obvious to these warring experts is apt to seem obvious, on reflection, to just about everybody. So the recommendation that you keep an eye out for a tacit shared false assumption is not all that likely to bear fruit, but at least you're more likely to find one if you're hoping to find one and have some idea of what one would look like. Sometimes there are clues. Several of the great instances of jutsing have involved abandoning some well-regarded thing that turned out not to exist after all. Phlogiston was supposed to be an element in fire, and caloric was the invisible, self-repellent fluid or gas that was supposed to be the chief ingredient in heat. But these were dropped, and so was the ether as a medium in which light traveled the way sound travels through air and water. But other admirable jutsings are additions, not subtractions. Germs and electrons, and maybe even the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics. It's never obvious from the outset whether we should jutes or not. Ray Jackendoff and I have argued that we must drop the almost always tacit assumption that consciousness is the highest or most central of all mental phenomena. And I have argued that thinking of consciousness as a special medium, rather like the ether, into which contents get transduced or translated, is a widespread and unexamined habit of thought that should be broken. Along with many others, I have also argued that if you think it is simply obvious that free will and determinism are incompatible, you're making a big mistake. More about those ideas later. Another clue? Sometimes a problem gets started when somebody way back when said, "Suppose for the sake of argument that," and folks agreed for the sake of argument, and then in the subsequent parry and thrust, everybody forgot how the problem started. I think that occasionally, at least in my field of philosophy, the opponents are enjoying the tussle so much that neither side wants to risk extinguishing the whole exercise by examining the enabling premises. Here are two ancient examples, which, of course, are controversial. 1. Why is there something rather than nothing is a deep question in need of an answer. 2. Does God command something because it is good, or is something good because God commands it, is another important question. I guess it would be wonderful if somebody came up with a good answer to either of these questions, so I admit that my calling them pseudo-problems not worth anybody's attention is not very satisfying, but that doesn't show that I'm wrong. Nobody said the truth had to be fun. 9. Three species of goulding: rathering, piling on, and the Gould two-step. The late biologist Stephen Jay Gould was a virtuoso designer and exploiter of boom crutches. Here are three related species of the genus goulding, named by me in honor of their most effective wielder. Rathering is a way of sliding you swiftly and gently past a false dichotomy. The general form of rathering is, "It is not the case that blah, 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 blah," as orthodoxy would have you believe. It is rather that such and such and such and such, which is radically different. Some ratherings are just fine. You really must choose between the two alternatives on offer. In these cases, you are not being offered a false, but rather a genuine, inescapable dichotomy. But some ratherings are little more than sleight of hand, due to the fact that the word rather implies, without argument, that there is an important incompatibility between the claims flanking it. Here's a fine example of rathering by Gould in the course of his account of punctuated equilibrium. Change does not usually occur by imperceptibly gradual alteration of entire species, but rather by isolation of small populations and their geologically instantaneous transformation into new species. 1992b, page 12. This passage invites us to believe that evolutionary change could not be both geologically instantaneous and imperceptibly gradual at the same time. But of course, it can be. In fact, that is just what evolutionary change must be, unless Gould is saying that evolution tends to proceed by saltations, giant leaps in design space. But elsewhere, he has insisted that he never ever endorsed saltationism. Geologically instantaneous speciation can happen over a short period of time, let's say 50,000 years, an elapse of time barely detectable in most geological strata. During that brief moment, a typical member of a species might increase in height from, say, half a meter to 1 meter, a 100% increase, but at a rate of a millimeter every century, which strikes me as an imperceptibly gradual change. Let's make up some other examples of rathering to make sure the nature of the trick is clear. It is not that people are mere moist robots, as Dilbert says with the concurrence of most researchers in cognitive science. It is rather that people have free will and are morally responsible for their good and bad deeds. Again, why not both? What is missing is an argument to the effect that moist robots cannot also be people with free will who are morally responsible. This example plays on a common but controversial assumption. Here's another. Religion is not the opiate of the masses, as Marx said. It is rather a deep and consoling sign of humanity's recognition of the inevitability of death. Yet again, why can't it be both the opiate and a consoling sign? I think you get the point by now, and you can hunt for ratherings in a document more easily than you can hunt for false dichotomies, which never get announced as such. Just type rather in your search box and see what comes up. Remember, not all rathers are ratherings. Some are legitimate, and some ratherings don't use the word rather. Here is one that uses the terser for blank, not blank. I made it up from elements in the work of several ideologues of cognitive science. Nervous systems need to be seen as actively generating probes of their environment, not as mere computers acting passively on inputs fed to them by sense organs. Who says computers acting on inputs fed to them can't actively generate probes? This familiar contrast between drearily passive computers and wonderfully active organisms has never been properly defended, and is one of the most ubiquitous imagination blockers I know. A variation on rathering used frequently by Gould may be called piling on. We talk about the march from monad to man, old-style language again, as though evolution followed continuous pathways of progress along unbroken lineages. Nothing could be further from reality. 1989A, page 14. What could not be further from reality? At first, it might appear as if Gould was saying there is no continuous unbroken lineage between the monads, single-celled organisms, and us. But of course there is. There is no more secure implication of Darwin's great idea than that. So what can Gould be saying here? Presumably, we are meant to put the emphasis on pathways of progress. It is only the belief in progress that is far from reality. The pathways are continuous, unbroken lineages, all right, but not lineages of global progress. This is true, they are unbroken continuous lineages of mainly local progress. We come away from this passage from Gould, unless we are wary, with the sense that he has shown us something seriously wrong with the standard proposition of evolutionary theory that there are continuous pathways, unbroken lineages, from monads to man. But, to use Gould's own phrase, nothing could be further from reality. Yet another trick of his is the Gould two-step, a device I described in print some years ago, which was then named by the evolutionary theorist Robert Trivers, Personal Correspondence, 1993, in honor of its inventor. In the first stage, you create the straw person and refute it. Everybody knows that trick. Second, this is the stroke of genius, you yourself draw attention to the evidence that you have taken the first step, the evidence that your opponents don't in fact hold the view you have attributed to them, but interpret these citations as their grudging first stage, you create the straw person and refute it. Everybody knows that trick. Second, this is the stroke of genius, you yourself draw attention to the evidence that you have taken the first step, the evidence that your opponents don't in fact hold the view you have attributed to them, but interpret these citations as their grudging concessions to your attack. Dennett, 1993, page 43. In my essay, A Letter to the Editor of the New York Review of Books, 1993, where Gould had 2 months earlier savagely criticized Helena Cronin's fine book, The Ant and the Peacock, November 19, 1992, I presented three examples of the Gould two-step. Here is the most portable of those examples. The most transparent case is Gould's invention of extrapolationism, described as a logical extension of Cronin's adaptationism. This is a doctrine of pan-continuity and pan-gradualism that is conveniently, indeed trivially, refuted by the fact of mass extinction. But if mass extinctions are true breaks in continuity, if the slow building of adaptation in normal times does not extend into predicted success across mass extinction boundaries, then extrapolationism fails and adaptationism succumbs. I cannot see why any adaptationist would be so foolish as to endorse anything like extrapolationism in a form so pure as to deny the possibility or even likelihood that mass extinction would play a major role in pruning the tree of life, as Gould puts it. It has always been obvious that the most perfect dinosaur will succumb if a comet strikes its homeland with a force hundreds of times greater than all the hydrogen bombs ever made. There is not a word in Cronin's book that supports his contention that she has made this error. If Gould thinks the role of mass extinction in evolution is relevant to either of the central problems Cronin addresses, sexual selection and altruism, he does not say how or why. When Cronin turns, in her last chapter, to a fine discussion of the central question in evolutionary theory she has not concentrated on, the origin of species, and points out that it is still an outstanding problem, Gould pounces on this as a last-minute epiphany, an ironic admission of defeat for her pan-adaptationism. Preposterous. Page 44. There is a good project for a student of rhetoric, combing through Gould's huge body of publications and cataloging the different species of boom crutch he exploited, beginning with Rathering, Piling On, and the Gould Two-Step. 10. The Surely Operator, a Mental Block. When you're reading or skimming argumentative essays, especially by philosophers, here's a quick trick that may save you much time and effort, especially in this age of simple searching by computer. Look for surely in the document and check each occurrence. Not always, not even most of the time, but often the word surely is as good as a blinking light locating a weak point in the argument, a warning label about a likely boom crutch. Why? Because it marks the very edge of what the author is actually sure about and hopes readers will also be sure about. If the author were really sure all the readers would agree, it wouldn't be worth mentioning. Being at the edge, the author has had to make a judgment call about whether or not to attempt to demonstrate the point at issue, or provide evidence for it, and, because life is short, has decided in favor of bald assertion with the presumably well-grounded anticipation of agreement. Just the sort of place to find an ill-examined truism that isn't true. I first noticed this useful role of surely when commenting on an essay by Ned Block, 1994, which included several prime examples directed against my theory of consciousness. Here's one, conveniently italicized by Block to emphasize its obviousness typographically. But surely it is nothing other than a biological fact about people, not a cultural construction, that some brain representations persevere enough to affect memory, control behavior, etc. Page 27. This is meant to dismiss, without argument, my theory of human consciousness as something that must, in effect, be learned, a set of cognitive microhabits that are not guaranteed to be present at birth. Wherever Block says, surely, I said, look for what we might call a mental block. Dennett, 1994A, page 549. Block is one of the most profligate abusers of the surely operator among philosophers, but others routinely rely on it, and every time they do, a little alarm bell should ring. Here is where the unintended sleight of hand happens, whisking the false premise by the censors with a nudge and a wink. Dennett, 2007B, page 252. I decided recently to test my hunch about surely a bit more systematically. I went through dozens of papers, about 60, on the philosophy of mind at philpapers.org and checked for occurrences of surely. Most papers did not use the word at all. In those that did use it, between 1 and 5 times in the sample I checked, most instances were clearly innocent. A few were, well, arguable, and there were 6 instances where the alarm bell sounded loud and clear, for me. Of course, others might have a very different threshold for obviousness, which is why I didn't bother tabulating my data in this informal experiment. I encourage doubters to conduct their own surveys and see what they find. A particularly egregious example of the surely operator will be dismantled in detail later, in Chapter 64. 11. Rhetorical questions. Just as you should keep a sharp eye out for surely, you should develop a sensitivity for rhetorical questions in any argument or polemic. Why? Because, like the use of surely, they represent an author's eagerness to take a shortcut. A rhetorical question has a question mark at the end, but it is not meant to be answered. That is, the author doesn't bother waiting for you to answer, since the answer is so flipping obvious that you'd be embarrassed to say it. In other words, most rhetorical questions are telescoped reductio ad absurdum arguments, too obvious to need spelling out. Here's a good habit to develop. Whenever you see a rhetorical question, try, silently to yourself, to give it an unobvious answer. If you find a good one, surprise your interlocutor by answering the question. I remember a Peanuts cartoon from years ago that nicely illustrates the tactic. Charlie Brown had just asked rhetorically, "Who's to say what's right and wrong here?" And Lucy responded in the next panel, "I will." 12. What is a deepity? My late friend, the computer scientist Josen Weizenbaum, had a yearning to be a philosopher and tried late in his career to gravitate from technicalities to profundities. He once told me that one evening, After holding forth with high purpose and furrowed brow at the dinner table, his young daughter Miriam said, "Wow, Dad just said a deepity. What a wonderful impromptu coinage." I decided to adopt it and put it to somewhat more analytic use. A deepity is a proposition that seems both important and true and profound, but that achieves this effect by being ambiguous. On one reading, it is manifestly false, but it would be earth-shaking if it were true. On the other reading, it is true, but trivial. The unwary listener picks up the glimmer of truth from the second reading and the devastating importance from the first reading and thinks, "Wow, that's a deepity." Here's an example. Better sit down. This is heavy stuff. Love is just a word. Oh, wow. Cosmic. Mind-blowing, right? Wrong. On one reading, it is manifestly false. I'm not sure what love is, maybe an emotion or emotional attachment, maybe an interpersonal relationship, maybe the highest state a human mind can achieve, but we all know it isn't a word. You can't find love in the dictionary. We can bring out the other reading by availing ourselves of a convention philosophers care mightily about. When we talk about a word, we put it in quotation marks. Thus, love is just a word. This is true. Love is an English word, but just a word, not a sentence, for example. It begins with L and has four letters and appears in the dictionary between lousy and lowbrowed, which are also just words. Cheeseburger is just a word. Word is just a word. But this isn't fair, you say. Whoever said that love is just a word meant something else, surely. No doubt, but they didn't say it. Maybe they meant that love is a word that misleads people into thinking that it is the term for something wonderful that doesn't really exist at all, like unicorn. Or maybe they meant that the word was so vague that nobody could ever know whether it referred to any particular thing or relation or event. But neither of these claims is actually very plausible. Love may be a troublesome, hard-to-define word, and love may be a hard-to-be-sure-about state, but those claims are obvious, not particularly informative or profound. Not all deepities are quite so easily analyzed. Richard Dawkins recently alerted me to a fine deepity by Rowan Williams, the Archbishop of Canterbury, who described his faith as a silent waiting on the truth, pure sitting and breathing in the presence of the question mark. I leave the analysis of this as an exercise for you. Summary. A tool wielded well becomes almost as much a part of you as your hands and feet, and this is especially true of tools for thinking. Equipped with these simple, all-purpose thinking tools, you can approach the difficult explorations ahead with sharper senses. You can see an opening, hear a warning bell, smell a rat, or feel a misstep that you might well miss without their help. You also have some maxims to bear in mind. Rappaport's rules and Sturgeon's Law, for instance, that can whisper advice in your ear like Jiminy Cricket, reminding you to control your aggression as you plunge boldly into the thicket swinging your weapons. Yes, thinking tools are also weapons, and the imagery of combat is appropriate. Competitiveness is, apparently, a natural byproduct of the intellectual ambition and boldness required to tackle the toughest problems. We've seen that in the heat of battle, even great thinkers can resort to dirty tricks in their eagerness to get you to see things their way, and constructive criticism can quickly shade into ridicule when an opportunity to launch a zinger arises. The problems we will be confronting are all hot-button issues: meaning, evolution, consciousness, and especially free will. You will feel dread or repugnance welling up as you approach some of the prospects, and rest assured that you are not alone in this. Even the most vaunted experts are susceptible to wishful thinking and can be blinded to a truth by a conviction that is supported more by emotional attachment than reason. People really care about whether they have free will or not, about how their minds can reside in their bodies, and about how, and even whether, there can be meaning in a world composed of nothing but atoms and molecules, photons and Higgs bosons. People should care. What could be more important in the end than these questions? What in the world are we and what should we do about it? So watch your step. There is treacherous footing ahead, and the maps are unreliable. 3. Tools for thinking about meaning or content. Why begin with meaning? I'm starting with meaning because it is at the heart of all the tough problems, for a simple reason. These problems don't arise until we start talking about them, to ourselves and others. Badgers don't worry about free will, and even dolphins can't be nagged by the problem of consciousness because asking questions is not part of their repertoire. Curiosity may have killed the cat, but it drives us reflective human beings into thickets of bafflement. Now, maybe this is the downside of language, and we'd be better off, happier, healthier mammals, if we were as oblivious to these issues as our great ape kin are. But since we have language, we're stuck with the big questions. And for better or worse, they don't strike us as trivial. The first step in any effective exploration is to get as clear as we can about our starting point and our equipment. Words have meaning. How is this possible? We word users mean things by saying things. How is this possible? How can we understand each other? Our dogs seem to be able to understand, sort of, a few words, even a few hundred words. But aside from such domesticated stunts and the rudimentary signaling systems found in nature, in primates and birds, in cuttlefish, words are what distinguish our minds from all other animal minds. That is a striking difference, but it still seems that non-human animals, higher animals, have minds, and hence in some perhaps limited way deal with meanings, the meanings of their perceptual states, their urges and desires, and even their dreams. Sometimes animals strike us as very much like us, as people dressed up in cat costumes, bear skins, and dolphin suits. This is true in every human culture. Animals are seen as seeing, knowing, wanting, trying, fearing, deciding, lusting, remembering, and so forth. In short, they are seen as like us in having minds filled with meaningful something or others. Ideas, beliefs, mental representations. How can there be meanings in brains? A perennially tempting idea is that since words have meanings, maybe the meaningful things in our brains, and in animal brains, are like words composed into mental sentences expressing beliefs and so on. But if words get their meanings from the minds that utter them, from where do mind words get their meanings? Do animal brains store both the mind words and their definitions in a sort of cerebral dictionary? And if animals, at least higher animals, have always had brains full of mind words, why can't they talk? The idea of a language of thought is deeply problematic, but our thoughts and beliefs must be composed of something. What else could it be? 13. Murder in Trafalgar Square. Here's our first intuition pump. Jacques shoots his uncle dead in Trafalgar Square and is apprehended on the spot by Sherlock. Tom reads about it in The Guardian, and Boris learns of it in Pravda. Now, Jacques, Sherlock, Tom, and Boris have had remarkably different experiences, to say nothing of their earlier biographies and future prospects. But there is one thing they share. They all believe that a Frenchman has committed murder in Trafalgar Square. They did not all say this, not even to themselves. That proposition did not, we can suppose, occur to any of them. And even if it had, it would have had very different import for Jacques, Sherlock, Tom, and Boris. Yet they all believe that a Frenchman committed murder in Trafalgar Square. This is a shared property that is visible, in effect, only from one very limited point of view. The point of view of folk psychology. Ordinary folk psychologists, all of us, have no difficulty imputing such useful commonalities to people. We do it without knowing much of anything about what lies between the ears of those to whom we attribute those beliefs. We may think that these four fellows must also have something else in common, a similarly shaped something or other in their brains that somehow registers their shared belief. But if so, we are lapsing into dubious theorizing. There may, in fact, be some such neural structures in common. If all four brains happen to spell the belief that a Frenchman has committed murder in Trafalgar Square the same way, but this is not at all necessary, and is in fact very unlikely for reasons we will briefly explore here. The two sentences, I'm hungry and j'ai faim, share a property. in spite of being composed of differently shaped letters, or different phonemes when uttered aloud, in different languages, and having different grammatical structures. They mean, or are about, the same thing, the speaker's hunger. This shared property, the meaning of the two sentences in their respective languages, or the content of the beliefs they express, is a central topic in philosophy and cognitive science. This aboutness that, for example, sentences, pictures, beliefs, and no doubt some brain states exhibit is known in philosophical jargon as intentionality, an unfortunate choice as a technical term, since outsiders routinely confuse it with the everyday idea of doing something intentionally, as in, are your intentions honorable? Here is a sentence to remind you of the differences. A cigarette is not about smoking or about anything else, in spite of the fact that it is intended to be smoked. A no smoking sign is about smoking and hence exhibits intentionality. It's about a possibly non-existent mugger, but it is surely not intentional in the ordinary sense. You don't believe it on purpose, it just comes to you. Running away from the tree is intentional in the ordinary sense, but isn't about anything. If you simply make a habit of substituting the awkward word aboutness whenever you encounter the philosophical term intentionality, you will seldom go wrong. Aside from the agreement that meaning and content are intimately related and mutually dependent phenomena, or even a single phenomenon, intentionality, there is still precious little consensus about what content or meaning is and how best to capture it. That's why we have to approach this topic gingerly. It's a feast of problems, but we can sneak up on the questions, taking small bites. This example of the four different believers is meant to demonstrate how brains could have little in common while still sharing an intentional property. Believing the same thing. Jacques was an eyewitness, indeed the perpetrator of the murder. Sherlock's experiential intimacy with the event is only slightly less direct. But Tom and Boris learned this fact in strikingly different terms. There are indefinitely many different ways of acquiring the information that a Frenchman committed murder in Trafalgar Square, and indefinitely many different ways of using that information to further one's projects. Answering questions on quiz shows, winning bets, titillating French tourists in London, etc. If there is a good reason to think that all these sources and outcomes must funnel through some common structure in the brain, we'll discover it eventually. But in the meantime, we shouldn't jump to conclusions. Before leaving this intuition pump, we should follow Doug Hofstetter's advice and turn the knobs to see what its parts are doing. Why did I choose the particular proposition I did? Because I needed something memorable and striking enough to get reported in different languages many miles away from the scene. Most of our belief acquisition isn't like that at all, and it is worth noting this. For instance, Jacques, Sherlock, Tom, and Boris share indefinitely many other beliefs that did not arise so dramatically. The beliefs that, for instance, chairs are larger than shoes, that soup is liquid, that elephants don't fly. If I try to inform you that salmon in the wild don't wear hearing aids, you will tell me that this is not news to you. But when did you learn it? You weren't born knowing it. It was not part of any curriculum at school. And it is extremely unlikely that you ever framed a sentence in your mind to this effect. So, while it might seem obvious that Boris must have learned about the Frenchman by simply uploading the relevant Russian sentence in Pravda into his brain and then translating it into, oh, brainish, there is nothing obvious about the supposition that Boris's brain performed a similar clerical job, from what into brainish, for the fact about salmon. Here's another knob. Suppose Fido, a dog, and Clyde, a pigeon, are also eyewitnesses of the murder. They may carry away something about the event, an adjustment in their brains that could influence later behavior. But it wouldn't be the fact that a Frenchman committed murder in Trafalgar Square, even though the information sustaining that fact might be present in the light and sound that impinged on their sense organs. A videotape of the event might provide legal evidence of this, for instance. But it would be lost on Fido and Clyde. So this intuition pump risks carrying a seriously anthropocentric bias into our exploration of meaning. Words and sentences are exemplary vehicles of meaning, but for animals that don't use them, the idea that their brains nevertheless use them is at least far-fetched, which doesn't make it false. If it turns out to be true, it will be a most eye-opening discovery. But we've had those before. The phenomena of intentionality are both utterly familiar, as salient in our daily lives as food, furniture, and clothes, and systematically elusive from scientific perspectives. You and I seldom have difficulty distinguishing a birthday greeting from a death threat from a promise, but consider the engineering task of making a reliable death threat detector. What do all death threats have in common? Only their meaning, it seems. And meaning is not like radioactivity or acidity, a property readily discriminated by a well-tuned detector. The closest we have come yet to creating a general-purpose meaning detector is IBM's Watson, which is much better at sorting by meanings than any earlier artificial intelligence system. But notice that it is not all simple, and would still, probably, misidentify some candidates for death threats that a child would readily get. Even small children recognize that when one laughing kid yells to another, "So help me, I'll kill you if you do that again," this is not really a death threat. The sheer size and sophistication of Watson are at least indirect measures of how elusive the familiar property of meaning is. 14. An older brother living in Cleveland. Still, meaning is not an utterly mysterious property. One way or another, structures in our brain somehow store our beliefs. When you learn that poodoos are mammals, something has to change in your brain. Something has to become relatively fixed in a way it wasn't fixed before you learned this, and whatever it is must have enough aboutness, one way or another, to account for your newfound ability to identify poodoos as closer kin to buffaloes than to barracudas. So it is indeed tempting to imagine that beliefs are stored in the brain rather the way data files are stored on your hard disk in some systematic code which might be different in each individual, as different as fingerprints. Jacques' beliefs would be written in his brain in Jacques-ish and Sherlock's in Sherlock-ish, but there are problems with this attractive idea. Suppose we have entered the golden age of neurocryptography, and it becomes possible for a cognitive micro-neurosurgeon to do bits of tinkering and insert a belief into a person's brain, writing the relevant proposition in the person's neurons using the local brain language, of course. If we can learn to read brain writing, presumably we can write brain writing, if our tools are delicate enough. Let us suppose we are going to insert into Tom's